I'd quite like to introduce you and say there is this doctor that lives in the West Country. He's now retired, orthopedic and trauma surgeon, that if Britannia was to go to her GP, I think David Halpin would be the best man for the job. He's a man who is one of the key people who made a decisive difference in the death of Dr. David Kelly, clarifying to the nation that the man was not committing suicide, instead was assassinated or murdered. And Dr. David Halpin, in his retirement, has kept a very, very close eye on many issues, including that of Palestine and the plandemic. So, David, if we could start this week looking at something which most doctors don't really generally consider, although there are quite a few now looking at the cost of living crisis and going on strike. What is your diagnosis on the economy? Because we've had these high street chains, the ones that have kicked out all the small businesses, many of them anyway, from our high streets and moved a lot of the trade to the out-of-town shopping centres. But the collapse of Wilko is quite extraordinary, I think, and it maybe is a way into looking at this in more depth. It's like the model is crumbling, falling apart at the moment. So what do you make of the economy?
Well, Tony, it's been predicted that there will be a serfdom, or at least they wish that there was a serfdom, where we own nothing and be happy. That's been predicted, I understand, by the World Economic Forum. Schwab, who I understand has shaken hands with our new king, King Charles III.
Well, they very much seem to be on the same page, those two, don't they?
He does. They do seem to be. And he's on the same page with climate change, that scam. He's on the page. I've, in fact, been to his farm up at Highgrove, was most impressed, as years ago now, with his organic farm. And I was always rather sympathetic to him. But the more I see of him, the more I dislike him and don't trust him.
Well, it's very similar with Tony Blair. Many people in 1997 thought, well, this is the guy. He's really left-wing. He's ex-campaign for nuclear disarmament. And as it turned out, maybe, you know, he was one of these Russian dolls with the devil in the middle.
Yes, he was. And I never forget the online quote when Thatcher attended a dinner party with Conall Burns in Eastleigh near Southampton. He'd failed, in fact, in his election attempt as an MP. And she said in her speech, and it's well quoted, I believe it, that the election of Tony Blair was the best thing that had happened in her political life. Absolutely key quote. To continue, I'm very close to to people locally in their shops. I speak to people on the Saturday in Newton Abbot, a rather beaten up town, courtesy of Tunbridge District Council. And I have a son who is in a building supply firm that's doing pretty well at the moment, or is ticking over. This is a bit quieter, I understand. But I see around me lots of tradesmen working very hard and diligently, and who often know what's going on. They lighten up when I speak about COVID and things like that. And I often say, this country is in the shit, and they agree. And I said, it won't be, because we're going to work to make sure it gets out of it. But I knew about the Wilko closure. That's 400 branches. The family firm going back to the 60s, I think. I've been patronizing it recently because they have excellent vegetable seed, which actually germinates, unlike the main companies, and it's about a third of the price. And the employees have been helpful and good too. But two people have looked to take them over, as they say. Currently, it's an HMV billionaire, apparently. But that's a very large, I think they employ many thousands of folk. And I think I care greatly about other people, Tony. That's why I was a doctor.
Well, look, let me just say one thing about Wilko, David, before you explain that.
Yes.
Because, I mean, this has happened with several big firms where it's been a small, successful business that's had massive investment put into it. It's been floated on the stock exchange, etc.
Yes.
And then it's found that actually this massive expansion is its death knell. I mean, that's the case for this Wilko Wilkinson's company. It's similar for Morrison's and people like that. Morrison's hasn't completely conked out, but, it's having all sorts of financial difficulties now, less people coming in. And so it's almost as if this dream that people who've run their own businesses have been lured into to expand and become a chain is actually a kind of poison chalice.
Yes. I don't know whether there was massive investment into Wilko. I don't know. They talk about the shelves being empty as being a factor. That was the COVID thing added to that, you know, the supply chain problems. But it certainly employs many people. And I think of those people who are signed up to mortgages, currently with interest rates rising, being actually terrorized because they won't have any jobs. And they've got mortgages to pay and the rest, and children to feed and clothe. Actually, mostly the young employees, I notice. There's another firm up in Yeovil. Yeovil is another beaten-up town, really. A lot of quite poor people there. And Pittards, who've made gloves for decades, are in administration too. Now, what I question is whether this is this being put on the skates is whether this is in fact being done deliberately via the banks and other mechanisms, or whether it's just happening because the economy has been destabilized. In my mind also is Mussolini's quotation regarding fascism, the amalgamation or the joining of the state with corporatism. And the people who are winning out all the time now, as you know, against the small and medium enterprises are the corporations. They've just given the permission, unfortunately, for Lidl's to open a store on the edge of Bubby Tracy and on the borders of our national park, which will kill the little town of Bubby Tracy stone dead in terms of its economy, I think. They don't seem to be worried, but I'm worried about it for them. So there's a process going on. Whether how much of it is being done willfully by various mechanisms, or how much of it is happening as the House of Cards collapse in a natural way, as it has done before in 2008. So that's what's in my mind. But now, today, I go down to Mole Valley Farmers, which has about 50 branches. It's a major supplier to farmers, to the horsey lot, and to many other people who come in for the food and other things. And I was met by a posse of their very pleasant employees, most of whom I know, all they're dressed in their black uniforms, looking rather like a police squad. And they were at the door saying, "We can only trade in cash today, Mr. Halpin. Have you got cash?" I said, "Yes, I have got cash." I said, "Let me in." I was followed around by the deputy manager with his clipboard, and he had to, very in a friendly way, and he had to record what I was buying. I bought £1.68 worth of onions. That was all. And he then followed me to the checkout, where a extremely obese chap I know very well then took my money. And that was recorded also. Now, they told me, the staff, that the computer system for Mole Valley, the whole lot, 50 branches, with I imagine thousands of employees, that the system had failed on Sunday morning, interestingly. Now, I did look up on news about Mole Valley, and there's a press release, I think on Monday, which made it sound, it certainly made it sound very serious, but it was temporary. Well, this is Thursday, so it's been going on for 4 days. And I recall that in ordering some steel flashing for a roof about 10 days ago, there was great concern that I shouldn't pay by check, but they should put on the account straight away. And then the account made sure with some input from Sue via online banking co-op. So there was perhaps some nervousness then about their financial status.
Now, have you done these sorts of transactions before? And have
Yes. I go to Mole Valley about once or twice a fortnight, and I've been a customer with them for 45 years.
Well, so can you just clarify what the difference was? And it was related to this computer outage.
Well, it was. But the thing is that what I have to question is whether, in fact, they're not on the blink. I think they are. The thing is that it's not, to be quite blunt, and without I would question whether some of the management decisions are good. It's all been reorganized inside of the store in a very effective way. They have a tremendous stock for a start, and they have a lot of staff too. And that's a factor. in trying to keep solvent.
Yeah, I mean, if there's not many people around, it may simply be because people have been turning up wanting to buy things with their cards and just found that, well, they're not allowed to today.
Well, exactly so. But the thing is, I know, having been a son of a father who was a small electronic business, radio and television, how much on a knife edge business is. And I can imagine that if for 1 week they can only trade in cash and people with credit cards and their accounts in Mole Valley are not going buying things, that in 1 week they will make a massive loss. I know that. So I think that they are in a critical state, and I wonder whether they are not going down the tube.
Well, it could be. I mean, I was in Axminster earlier this week, and if you go opposite Mole Valley's, it's a sort of mini supermarket, isn't it? In Axminster, what you'll find is British Rail, South West Trains. They're going most days on that line from Salisbury down to Exeter. But earlier this week, I was down there buying a train ticket. And something extraordinary, the lady at the ticket office, amazingly there was still a ticket office, obviously it would have been interesting if there was just a machine that only accepts a credit card, said that, I'm sorry, it's only cash today.
That has been a frequent refrain.
And it was, and she explained also that it was the whole of South West Trains, all the way from Waterloo down, that was only accepting cash. I think it was this Tuesday.
Well, the thing is that this, two questions then, is that because they're afraid of any non-cash transaction for their viability, or is it another mechanism to destabilize the system? And I suspect it's the second, because as you know, they're closing ticket offices, and we've been encouraged to write, one of our local MPs has been campaigning against it supposedly, but we know my wife's sight is failing badly, and I took her to the machine, you know, the screen, about 4 months ago, and it was only an employee who helped us out. But what they're proposing is unacceptable and is likely to cause the railways to fail. So my good friend Jo, who sees a lot, she says, well, don't forget, David, that they don't want you to travel. The 15-minute limit to journeys in the cities, you know, in Cambridge, in Bristol, which you're seeing in Bristol, and elsewhere, is part of this mechanism. It's part of the serfdom where, for this ridiculous net zero carbon, all sorts of things are being imposed on us. And I suspect the railways are adhering to government diktat. Well, and I'm fairly certain actually of that. Do you know how many train companies there are, Tony? There are 35 train companies.
Well, 35. The other thing with this particular incident was that at the station, there's something almost Python-esque about Axminster Station, because a few minutes before the train arrives there, it's only about 1 hour or so in each
direction. Yes, that's right. Waterloo line, yeah.
The ticket office, a little light goes out, the sign comes up closed. So anybody sort of turning up within 5 minutes before the train cannot use a ticket office, and because the wonderful stalwart lady there who's serving tickets has to put on her high-vis jacket, go through a door, lock up the ticket office, go out onto the platform and pick up a phone to ring through to some signal person, and then seize the train in and seize the train out. So all of the time that the train is actually there every hour, the ticket office is closed. There's only one member of staff, for goodness sake.
Well, that is under the general title, which I keep saying all the time. What they're doing, I say this to Sue, my wife, they're harassing you in every possible way. And that, what you describe at Axminster, is harassment. And, of course, this is what Mick Lynch and the RMT and Asliff are fighting. They know they are destroying the system deliberately.
And
they're standing up for the customers.
Can you say something, David, about the nurses have settled in the health service, haven't they, but doctors are still on strike?
Yes, the nurses have settled because the Royal College of Nursing is in hock. to government. You know, they're the same old thing, actually. I'm surprised the BMA is standing up for the doctors.
But the Royal College of Nursing really does only reflect the wishes of nurses, and maybe it's simply that the nurses have thought, well, actually, we're getting a few more percent, let's stop it now, because it's a horribly traumatic thing to be in an industrial dispute in such an important industry, and many of those nurses just want to get on and do the job.
I realise that, Tony, and some of them will have had fatigue. You know, they've been worn down, and they're wearing people down all the time. But they haven't been given a good settlement. And the Royal College of Nursing, I was very surprised to find that they were leading the fight. Years ago, they were the most docile group of people, and they did not represent the majority of nurses. It used to be Unison who did that, but the Unison, I don't know, I can't say, most of the unions infiltrated anyway. We know that, and they are useless for their members.
That's true, but some bright sparks have pointed out that the percentage settlement they've got is actually works out, if you're looking at the food, comparing it, for example, to the food inflation, as a pay cut.
I can imagine that. I know these things, Tony. And the people that are, you know, they've now got food banks at some hospital sites, apparently. But I know that these people, I know them. I've worked with thousands of nurses, most of them the best people who care for people, and they love their job. And they've traded on that. I love my job, but they traded on that too, really. My operating, some years ago now, but I worked out, I never worried about pay very much, to be frank about it. But I was paid on average about £48 for each operating session of 3.5 hours. Well, that was quite cheap labour, if you look at it. But I didn't worry about that. And of course, I had a private practice as well. Ah, they cry, you know, the so-called left, private practice. That was a contract between me and a patient who came to me, referred by a GP who respected me. That's beside the point. I've written about the junior doctors several times in the local paper. I can send you the piece. It's a good piece. And I wrote the other day to the Western Morning News last Friday. It was published on Monday, the bank holiday Monday. It's a very long letter by me. I don't know how many words it is, but they didn't put it in as a special letter with a separate headline. It was put in as a letter, about two columns length, actually. But it describes my illness when I was a young houseman at St. Mary's, getting the plumb job in the medical unit, where for 10 days I was the sole houseman looking after 50 very ill patients, or mostly very ill patients. And I broke down on the 10th day and had to be admitted voluntarily to a sanatorium. And why I wrote this letter, and then later on, I had a second breakdown after years of reasonable health. I got a bit down at times because of the deliberate, malign interference of the health service by politicians of all parties, political football. And again, in 1992, I had another illness, but it was due mostly to lack of a thyroid hormone. It took me months, in fact, had a diagnosis made in a private facility. But I've outlined how a conscientious doctor who loved his job, I said in my piece that to serve as a doctor and surgeon was joyful and was beyond words, and I mean that, and a privilege as well, actually, I mean that. But describing how poorly we look after young doctors, and how about half of them, in fact, found depressed in the first years of their service in the health service, partly because the consultants don't care enough, to be blunt about it, but the system doesn't either. But I ended, in fact, my piece, and this was quite a potent piece. I referred to Rose Polge. She was a petite, and I think probably a very good little physician. She was working as a senior house. She was working one of the lower grades at Torbay Hospital. And she began to feel, I think, that she wasn't up to it. And I think she was depressed. And I wonder how much her seniors, even the middle grades, had noted that her behavior was different or that she was down in the mouth. I don't know. But on February the 16th, in 2016, she went down to Meadfoot Beach in Torquay in the night on a cold, cold, windy night, swam out, and she was found, as I imagined she would be, I thought it then actually, in Portland in April, on Portland Beach. And she represents quite a few people in medicine whose care is taken for granted and are not cared for properly. And I know these junior doctors, they will find it difficult to strike. I know that. And having been a junior doctor, they are a bit different, perhaps, now than we used to be. We were perhaps rather more regimented. I don't know. I have to think about that. But there are some differences, perhaps. But mostly, they're young people who want to do a good job. They're not cared for properly. And this minister, I forget his name now, Dan, he knows nothing about health. And he's obdurate in response to their demands for a reasonable salary. And they can see it. And they know they're being ignored.
I think it's Stephen Barclay. I mean,
Barclay. God, don't I?
Don't
tell me.
But you
have to look at him. You have to see him.
The doctors are asking for 35%, David. I mean, this is.
I know, but the thing is, that I understand that if you go back, they've been losing out for about 10 years, and they're talking about a salary that, in fact, equates with inflation to what they were receiving 10 years ago. I don't know the details, but the thing is that they are, you know, when you think, we're in this Thatcher's property-owning democracy, look at what you require now to get a mortgage. What young doctor who hasn't got family wealth behind him could afford even to start renting a house?
One particular reason for this is that the morale of doctors is so low that actually
I know.
What they're seeing around them, their colleagues literally upping sticks and leaving the country for much better jobs abroad.
I know, and then we import people, often very good and well-meaning people, some very well-trained, some not so well-trained, from countries where they need doctors more than we do. And I can think of India and Punjab, all sorts of places like that. I've worked with almost every nationality in the world in my job in the health service. And I enjoyed my international contacts very much. Some of them lasted to this day. So that's, I can't discuss the detail of their claim, but I know they're not treated well. And my letter to the Western Morning News, I hope will be read by some senior doctors, but I wrote today or yesterday to the letters editor saying, please give me a PDF of my letter or letters page, because I'd forgotten that I wasn't one of two house physicians. I was one of one looking after this 50 patients. And I did not sleep for 10 days. That's a jolly good way of torturing people.
But it is,
As you know.
Sleep deprivation, yes. We don't want to give the government too many ideas there. But anyway, David, let's just take a step back a little bit and look, because with this crisis in the health service, in fact, in public service generally in the UK, in education most definitely too.
Yes.
We've just been talking a bit about the railways. In these, you know, basically the infrastructure of the nation, it seems to be crumbling. The people who are trying to keep it going are being stabbed in the back in many ways. And, you know, there's a crisis at the heart of the nation, really. And but I mean, at the same time, we're backing this war between Russia and Ukraine, in fact, to such an extent that we're now seeing incredible weapons being used that the Ukrainians would be very difficult for them to develop on their own, which are hitting into the heart of Russia. And it does seem as if it's almost become mythologized with the Zelensky as this kind of David and Goliath battle.
Yes. Just be quickly say, to summarize the previous process, I say destabilize, demoralize, dismantle. That's what they've done to the health service, and they did it surreptitiously. And the same technique is being applied to the other major public services. Russia and today, just think that our government, completely unopposed by Herr Starmer, and the so-called Liberal Democrats and the one Green, is sending U-238 tipped missiles to the Ukraine. It's sending drones. It's in fact using satellite imagery to show the Russian positions. That's via the US satellites. No doubt we've got involved in that as well. What is on is a full-blown war against Russia. And the United States, I'm not sure whether the Republicans are on side, I imagine they are, they stated that they want to destroy Russia. They want to balkanize Russia. It's a massive country with a strong patriotism, and with massive mineral resources. But that is their aim. They won't achieve it, I don't think, because they're very wily people, the Russian opposition, good chess players. And I know that in Ukraine, they're losing. Last, on the other night on the BBC, there was that ghastly reporter, who was often from the Middle East, named just escaped me in the moment, Scots accent. But he was there in Ukraine for 4 minutes, and he showed the mass graves on the Ukrainian side in the east of the Ukraine. I noticed that in one of the clips, there were several hundred unmarked graves. So they obviously had corpses that could not be identified. And there was film of the body bags being brought in, and a rather glum-looking lady, whose husband had been lost, I think, in the war, was in fact trying to identify them and inform the relatives. But their losses are massive. And as they say, the Newland et al. Want the Ukrainians to fight on to the last death. It's almost happening like that. And the people going to the front line on the Ukrainian side are not trained. And apparently they're often conscripted. So you can see what's going on.
Well, look, what is going on is we're seeing increasing attacks deeper into Russia.
I know.
Artillery of various sorts. So I wonder what you make of that. I mean, what we've basically got is we've got the targeting information is coming from satellite intelligence of the NATO countries, the United States and Britain, yes, etc. Yep. So they're saying, here, we found something at these particular coordinates, which it might be a good idea to destroy, you know, and,
yes,
and the equipment is being handed to them, the drones, etc., from the Western NATO countries too, as well as these long-range missiles that can fire up to 100 miles, sometimes more than 100 miles. This equipment is rolling up. So really, all the Ukrainians are doing is Ukrainian army man may actually just sort of press a button, whereas all the equipment he's using, all the intelligence to target the Russians, is coming from elsewhere. So I'm quite certain in the Russians' mind, they are now thinking, well, if NATO is going to be supplying the intelligence to do targeting, it's going to be supplying the equipment, then NATO is part of this war, and it's almost academic as to whether the war is going to open up to being with those NATO countries that are doing the targeting and supplying of weapons at some point. Say, for example, just a conjecture that the National Security Agency in the United States or GCHQ may be destroyed.
Well, that's a point, because in fact Lavrov and others have in fact responded in certain things to say that it is quite obvious that Britain especially and America especially, and of course the NATO surrogates, NATO puppets, including the Scandinavian countries, are part of the war on Russia. And we are at war with Russia, no question. And we then, in fact, remember that the Americans have regarded for 15 years at least some of their nuclear missiles, now on their subs patrolling the Atlantic with a 6,000-mile range, able to strike Iran. They are, in fact, there in the Mediterranean probably as well, able to strike Russia. And they are talking about them being tactical. Tactical. What a lie.
The Baltic, too. That's rather close.
We're talking about a tinderbox. And as you know, that I forget the organization's name now, something about the American scientists, nuclear war. But they have a clock, don't they? And they say the clock is nearest to midnight than ever before. And I understand it, actually. But they managed to massage the global mind to think it's never happened up to now, and it won't happen again. Well, it happened, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The only people who've used it so far are the Americans. But you will remember on the previous discussion, I'm certain that these enhanced nuclear weapons in Iraq I'm certain of that, and I've been criticised for saying it, but I'm certain of it. Well, not many.
I'm not going to criticise you at all. I mean, I know you have evidence of that, and it's on your website, but
I have.
We do know, actually, that even after the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, that doesn't mean to say that particle accelerators like the CERN accelerator and the Swiss Border, that Joint European Torus at Cullum Laboratory, south of Oxford in the UK,
yes.
These are used to create the conditions and the heat that nuclear weapons explode under. And so they can try out various materials. They don't need to do atmospheric tests with this so-called civilian program. And it's worth noting that Tube Alloys in Britain, which developed the nuclear weapons here after World War II and during World War II, as well as the Nazi nuclear weapons program during World War II, were all actually under a civil cover. So it was supposed to be a civilian program. Exactly the same seems to be happening now with CERN and with the Cullum Laboratory. So it seems that if you've got the technology to have a massive particle accelerator, you can still do nuclear weapons experiments. It's just you're not doing them in the atmosphere anymore.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, this leads me to think of a paper I saw today, I think, or some news item, that the Americans quite obviously regard the Ukraine as their patch. And you know that the Russians allege that they took over biolabs in Ukraine, and Newland confirmed it by saying they were concerned that they'd be overtaken by the invading Russian forces, and they'd been closed down and stuff had been destroyed. So there's another area for discussion there. And I also learned that BlackRock and other vast financial entities in the States are now buying up tracts of land in the Ukraine, just as Gates is buying up tracts of land in the US of A. You couldn't make it up. And I go back to my off-stated current maxim: there is no depth to which the psychopath will not sink.
Yeah, you're right. And it's interesting talking about the bio labs, because I know there's been a lot of Lyme's disease around this year, which is most tick bites are fairly harmless. You'll get, if you discover the tick while it's on you, then, you know, you've got to yank the thing out, basically, and put a bit of Savlon on there, and it might be sore for a little while. But some of the ticks have got this extra thing called Lyme's disease in, and I know you know a little bit about, there are allegations, I don't know if you can help clear it up, that was a deliberately developed bioweapon of some kind that was actually injected into the animals in order to sort of weaponize this little creature.
Well, I've got up a paper, which is good. It's by Makia Freeman, M-A-K-I-A, on Global Research, and it's entitled Bioweapons, Lyme Disease, Weaponized Ticks. Now, I don't take everything for gospel, but having read this through again, I read it when it was first published, actually, in 2019. I read it again, actually. It's about the bug in the which is caused the Lyme disease, called Borrelia burgdorferi. And in fact, Burgdorferi is a bacteriologist still alive, actually, in the States. I think he was involved, actually, earlier on with some of the research. But this is a good article, actually, and it goes back, it reminds us how many times nations, Japan, America, Britain, other countries, Russia, have looked for ways of using viruses and bacteria as bioweapons, and how insect vectors can be used to distribute them. The Japanese apparently did it on the Chinese, as recorded. And, you know, it's always very important to remember that this country is at the center of so many things. Portendown, the institution there is called Portendown Defense, inverted commas, establishment. Well, you know very well that sarin was developed there, first of all, sarin. And quite a few other things are going on there now, actually, which are not all about defense. For instance, in the campus there, there's a firm that I've written about, it's on my website, that produces an anthrax vaccine for the US forces. In fact, they stopped importing it because it was contaminated, apparently, in 2016-17. But I just remind people, they don't know it actually, this, but in the 50s, I think Porton and I was organizing the aerial spraying of a harmless bacteria, I think a coliform, over the Dorset coastline and countryside. And they were seeing how many people acquired it. I'm not sure how, I can't remember the details of that. But it was no question, it was fact. And it's been done many times since in the States, using chemicals in one place. I've seen one, in fact, they used a fluorescent chemical. It was a cadmium sulfide, something sulfide, and it was fluorescent. But it was in a particular, size which allowed inhalation. So they could pick it up in lungs, obviously, and see whether it had been inhaled. But this was done to the American population, without the population being told, no doubt. It's been discovered later. It's a rather freer country for information like this than our own. We're much better at concealing things, like the anthrax in that island that was a testbed during World War II, where they still found anthrax bacilli a few years ago when they went into this quarantined island. I just forget the name of the island now. But we're up to no good.
David, is it Plum Island?
Is it? No, Plum Island. Plum Island was where there was a American bioweapons laboratory off the Connecticut coast, and that's where they looked at the tick being a vector. And this is put forward as evidence. They say the highest density of Lyme disease in the States is in the 16 states proximate to Plum Island off the coast of Connecticut. Well, that isn't evidence. That isn't proof to me, actually, but that's said. And I wouldn't put it past them. We know very well, we think about the anthrax attacks following the preceding the invasion and destruction of Iraq and many of its people. That was before that, the anthrax attacks. You remember they found it in envelopes sent to senators and to in postal service workers in New York. And then there were four deaths in Florida. I looked into that and I reacted very speedily and very seriously because I thought it was a preemptive, frightening attack to justify an attack on Iraq then. Pearl was in fact pronouncing at the time, our friend Pearl. So we know they've been up to, we know that bioweapons have been in the mind of the psychopathic people running our countries for many, many years. And in regard to the Ukraine and the biolabs, we have to remember that it is said by the Russians they were working on using migrating birds to transmit avian flu. Now that's the thought, isn't it? You think of the gannets dying in large numbers in the gannet colonies around Scotland, and they've been found, oddly, in the dying ones to have not dark irises, but pale ones. Very strange, that.
Yeah, well, finally...
I'm looking into that at the moment, actually.
This is, I remember Vincenzo Vinciguerra, who was interviewed by Alan Frankovich for his Gladio, three-part Gladio series he did for the BBC, for the Time Watch series back in 1992, saying the following. In 1940, well, he'd basically been used by NATO to blow up innocent Italians in an attempt to blame it on the Red Army faction and the left groups in Italy. Yeah. And he said in 1940, this is in the 1970s and 1980s, he said in 1945, World War II ended and World War III began.
I agree with that utterly. And I talk about the continuum of fascism. The fascists that existed in our country before the Second World War, and they were back there in the days of the Tolpa de los Martyrs in 1842, 1843, because they wanted to crush the life out of people working on the land. So they're the same people. It was then the church, the state, and the law. They were at it then, and nothing has changed,
well,
Tony.
One thing has changed. We've had an announcement this week about a new variant of COVID, which is called Eris, E-R-I-S, Eris.
Yes.
And another couple, I mean, I don't know why they use these stupid little letters, these silly letters, EG5 and BA2 86. I would rather call it Eris, but anyway, apparently there are a new set of jabs already. As soon as this new Eris has appeared, amazingly, the vaccine companies are almost ahead of the mutations of the virus themselves and the yes. flu. And there, I listened to an announcement on the radio yesterday on Wednesday this week. Actually saying, well, these are going to be targeted at people in care homes and pregnant women.
And you know, the miscarriage rate in the reported from America in certain, I think several reports now, but certainly the ones, you know, from those working for the forces in America are closely monitored for their health. And the miscarriage rate in the women, well, obviously in the women, is at an extraordinary rate. I think it's like 80% or something like that, up from about 30%, the normal rate. But Tony, we are dealing with elemental evil. I've been writing today to a woman called Ros Maidment's her married name. She's a paediatrician, retired. She's been writing to the MHRA about the trials on children. I've been taking part in that by signing letters, but about 18 months ago, because of the Oxford group tied up with AstraZeneca, wanting to study the trial, the AstraZeneca so-called vaccine, what I call toxic junk, on 7 cohorts of children from ages 6 up to 17. And I was alerted to it, I thought about it, and I wrote to the chief constable of Thames Valley Police, Oxford being on his batch. He never replied, John Campbell, but that trial stopped. We don't know why it stopped. They might have had adverse reactions. The child might have died. I don't know. There was another reason why they might have stopped. But I never had any information. I asked Professor Pollard, who perceived this in a light bulb moment, this ruddy vaccine for AstraZeneca, why it had stopped. He didn't reply. But I've been writing to him and for GMC about him because he fails to answer questions about the vaccine. I've asked some basic questions. It starts off with the chimpanzee virus, adenovirus. I asked what disease was that the chimpanzees were suffering from, that the virus relates to. I asked him how stable it was, because they're using it, it's meant to be an inactive virus. And you know what? Once they've inserted the RNA strand into this adenovirus, you know how it's incubated? It's incubated in the broth produced by human fetal kidney cells obtained by a medical, i.e. often an illegal abortion, 40 years ago. That's what, if people knew that, if they had properly informed consent, the vast majority of people that had any sense would have said, no thanks. Today I've had an email from my own practice, which is a good practice, saying that the flu jab, second time I've had it actually, the flu jab is now available and I can have the COVID vaccination at the same time. They won't be getting a reply from me.
Well, it's almost as if they're chomping at the bit here because
they are, exactly.
The flu is a winter problem, and it's almost like the last day of summer. Suddenly, it's time for your flu jab.
Exactly, that's the point. And I think of that. The thing is that they had banners outside the practice. All fact, it was there for months about your flu jab, and I think they had a poor response. Probably, although I saw people sitting there with their masks on, waiting to be jabbed a few months ago, I think. But listen to this, Tony, that Moderna, which has had a higher rate of so-called myocarditis, it's vastly underreported anyway, but young people have had damage to their hearts from which they will never recover. The muscle cells of the heart, once they're dead, are dead. There's no recovery. There's no stem cell which starts then producing new muscle cells for the heart. So Moderna, which has a
hang on a second. If you're mentioning Moderna, well, we've had an announcement this week about Jonathan Van Tam has now become one of their top members of staff, chief advisors.
What's his name?
Van Tam. I think you might remember him.
Don't tell me. I didn't know that. But what a psychopath. and I can say it to his, I'll say it to his face if I have to in court.
So, David, the main point here is many of us may have friends and loved ones who are considering getting this COVID jab, are concerned about it. What would you say to them?
I'd say that, do you trust the people who are promoting it? Do you think it's necessary? Because most people who are healthy, who have an intact immune system, unfortunately, the vaccination, the COVID vaccination, is depressing their immunity. We know that. It's well proven. But if you've got an intact immune system, you have no need for a vaccine against this variety of the coronavirus family. So it's not necessary. And that's a lot of discussion about this thing is often assuming. They never talk about necessity. It's unnecessary. That's the first thing. But listen to this, Tony, that Moderna, and you know where the name comes from. Do you know what? M-O-D-R-N-A. That's where the name comes from. Moderna are starting, they've already recruited, they say, about 10,000 people from the ages of 12 upwards for trials in 22 centres. Bradford is one of them, but there's some in this area too, actually. I can't remember which. But I have been writing to Ros Jones today saying, I said that I would write the chief constable of the West Yorkshire to say that what they're proposing is a criminal assault, just as I said in the same words to Chief Constable John Campbell 18 months ago regarding the Oxford trial. But the idea, the first thing is, children don't need it. The death rate from COVID variants in children is microscopic. I think about 17 deaths of children in this country, probably with inherited immune deficiency. I don't know.
Well, also with other conditions.
What?
With other conditions, so we're talking about COVID.
Yes, exactly. But listen to this, Tony. This trial of this Moderna vaccine is meant to be bivalent against two of the COVID variants, and I suspect that in the laboratory in Wuhan and the other laboratories, some in Connecticut actually, in the States, but they've been working on these bloody things for years anyway, and they know what the effect is using primates. But they've also probably made it more easily mutatable. The mutability has been increased. So the more variants are going to be produced. That's, of course, that delights them. That's what they've done it for, really. But listen to this. This Moderna trial on ages 12 upwards, I think they're focusing on children particularly. They're talking about getting £1,500, the bounty, apparently, someone says. But it is not a proper trial with the Moderna vaccine, bivalent vaccine against the placebo saline or something similar, something which is innocuous. It's against another Moderna vaccine. So it's not a trial. So if there are any adverse effects, there will be some adverse effects on placebo as well, you see.
Well,
so they won't show the difference.
It's probably,
we're dealing with elemental evil, Tony.
Well, I mean,
it is unbelievable.
Well, it isn't, because it's happened before. There was a certain doctor you may have heard of called Dr. Mengele.
Mengele, and I call them Mengelists, these people. They are Mengelists.
They do seem to be.
It is a continuum.
Yeah.
Fascism isn't a sufficient enough word.
Trial like that really is experimenting on humans, isn't it? Anyway, look, David, just to get your.
Well, experimenting. The thing is that we know now that this is. There's a paper out today from Global Research which shows that the human genome is being altered forever in many people. We don't, and in fact, it may turn on oncogenes, the genes which in fact promote tumours in us. You could.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is obviously an evil element in here, a kind of eugenicist, and I think once you understand that eugenics is a discipline, is a profession, the Malthusians, you know.
Yeah, I know.
And we do know that there are evil people out there that get pleasure from seeing others suffer. But anyway,
yes.
David. And what I think is probably most useful is to get your website address so people can find it quite easily.
Right. It's easily done. D. Halpin. DHALPIN. DHALPIN. Dot info action. One word. INFO action. ACTION. .org. .UK. If you want some peace and beauty, click on the peacock butterfly, 9-minute video of me telling how to avoid backache with gardening. It shows our lovely garden here, emphasizing that I love beauty in the natural world, and I reject utterly the blackness of these people. The blackness. I love light, and I like love, and I'm kind to people. I became a doctor because I cared for people, and I cared for thousands with very good teams at my side. And I am proud of that. Proud, I don't like the word pride, but it was joyful. It was joyful. I know that there are minds, there are flawed human beings who love to destroy. They've been at it for eons of time. But most people I know are innately good, and I look towards that. And I encourage people all the time to light up.
Well, I think there's one positive thing about all of this, and that is that the human spirit actually does always fight back. And the idea that I think these the World Economic Forum types, your Schwabs, your arms lobby, your big pharma, these characters, satanic or otherwise, they believe their own propaganda, and so they tend to overstretch themselves.
They're not very bright, actually. They're not very bright, Tony.
They may be on a hiding to nothing.
They are on the hiding to nothing. We are winning. I know that, actually. And I say to Joe and other people that when the oppression becomes greater, that the spirit swells. And I see the spirit swelling in many people. Many people don't want to know the truth. They deny the truth. And later, when they've been vaccinated and they're suffering ill effects from that, they are ashamed that they were afraid of the truth. They're afraid of the truth now, and later they will be ashamed that they were afraid of the truth.
Yeah, one of the side effects of all of this is there's many more people waking up, you might say. Anyway, David Halpin, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tony, very much for asking me.